Welcome, everyone. This is the last class of this series on Parshat Mishpatim, but we will continue with a new series next week that is also about a theme that appears in Parshat Mishpatim, and that's the theme of widows, strangers, and orphans. And so there will be some continuity for those who wish to continue, but if people wish to join, for Elul, they will see a congruent unit of text. It would be impossible to do Parshat Mishpatim without doing the theme that we will be looking at today. Perhaps the most famous theme in Parshat Mishpatim, and it became famous because the Gemara talks about it a lot, and most of us who have studied Gemara actually began our studies way back when we were kids looking at this theme from Parshat Mishpatim, which is the theme of, put you out of your suspense, the theme of the goring ox, the most celebrated animal in legal history. Why is there so much interest in the goring ox in cross-culturally? So Professor Elaine Goodfriend, and maybe some of you who live off on the West Coast don't know her, has written, modern scholars suggest that the appearance of the goring ox in ancient Near Eastern law collections reflects ancient jurists' fascination with the ambiguity of property which possesses will, but not human intelligence. That's what an animal has, will, and it doesn't have human intelligence. You could say that it has a form of intelligence, but it doesn't have human intelligence. And so the question of the amount of responsibility of the owner of an animal for what the animal does when the animal has not acted, we're not talking about somebody sicking their goring ox or sicking their dog on somebody. We're talking about the problem of an animal exercising what could easily be called an act of will done by the animal, and harming other human, either harming human beings or harming other animals. And this would be true also of the biblical collections, says Professor Goodfriend, that there's a fascination with this legal question of what the responsibility that I have for my animal is. And we'll discuss this at some length today. And just before we start looking at text, I want to see this little introduction from Professor Elaine Goodfriend. And, you know, as I was preparing this class, I also bumped into a comment about an issue that I never thought of before by Professor Gary Ramsberg, who points out, most ancient Near Eastern languages, Hebrew and Akkadian among them, do not distinguish between a bull and an ox. Accordingly, many scholars call this case that we'll be talking about today the case of the goring ox. But oxen, because they have been castrated, are quite docile, and they are much less likely to gore than bulls whose strength and virility are well known. So Gary Ramsberg thinks that it would be more appropriate to call this case the case of the goring bull than to call it the case of the goring ox. I'm not so sure. I'm agnostic. I'm not certain about this because, as we'll see, and the assumption is that if you own a shore and that shore goes and damages some other animal or a human being, the assumption is that there's something surprising about this, that
something unexpected about it.
And if we're actually dealing with a bull that has not been castrated, and we all know that bulls can be very dangerous. So I don't know whether the better translation is the goring ox or the goring bull, but I'm grateful to Professor Rendsburg for raising the issue.
Okay. So
we're going to take the text from Parshat Mishpatim out of order, and we will start with the second text about the goring ox, which is ox gores ox. What happens when one ox gores another ox? Okay, so here's what it says in Parshat Mishpatim. V'chi gosh shor ish et shor re'elu v'amit. When a man's ox injures his neighbor's ox and it dies, they shall sell the live ox and divide its price, and they shall also divide the dead animal. If, however, it is known that the ox was in the habit of goring and its owner failed to guard it, he must restore ox for ox, but he shall keep the dead animal. So the distinction here between damage that is done by an ox where the owner has not been warned, and damage that has been done by an ox after the owner was warned. Hey, your ox is a dangerous ox. You should be protecting people from from this dangerous animal that you have there. So, it seems like the default here appears to be that you don't expect this animal to be doing anything, harmful. And it's your responsibility becomes full responsibility only after you've been warned that your ox has been going around goring. You should do something about it. You should guard it. And then, in that case that you've been warned, then you pay full damages. But in the first case described here, you end up paying half damage. Now, so what's the idea of paying half the damages? The Gemara discusses this. There are two opinions expressed in the Gemara about why you would pay half the damage. And, just think about it. If I am responsible in some way for some damage that was done by my house, by my property, by my animal, by my child, all of these things, you can ask the question, to what extent should I be responsible for damages that I didn't do, but that something that I own or that I have control over did? And, the two reasonable, logical positions to take are either to say, yes, you are responsible for what your animal does, and you shall pay if your animal does damage. Or to say, no, the animal has will of its own, and unless I've been warned specifically about the animal, it's easy to see the logic of a law code that would say, no, you're not responsible for the damage done by your animal unless you've been specifically warned that your animal is a dangerous animal, or the position that says that you are responsible. You own that animal. If you don't control that animal, then you are responsible. So either of those positions has a certain logic to it, but why would the Torah say, well, you'll pay half the damages. So the Gemara, if there's anybody here who has been doing the Daf Yomi, this was just in last week's Daf Yomi.
Rav Papa Amar Stam Shvarim Lav
Bechezkat Shimur Kaine. Oxen in general are considered insufficiently guarded. If you own an ox, you should feel responsibility to be guarding that ox. You should be worried about that ox. Logically, the owner should pay full damages, since the reasonable thing to say to an ox owner is, you should be guarding that ox. You should be making sure that the ox is behind a fence or whatever. Logically, the owner should pay full damages. But God had compassion on owners who have never been warned. But then the Torah is actually presenting the leniency here and saying, even though it makes sense that you should be paying full damages, we'll say you only have to pay half damages. And then Rav Huna says, as generally happens in the Gemara when you have two opinions on the subject, Rav Huna says the precise opposite.
Oxen in general
are considered sufficiently guarded. And so it's hard to know how to translate that Hebrew phrase there. Stam shvarim bechesnak shimur kaime. But it's they are considered sufficiently guarded. Are they considered sufficiently tame? In other words, it shouldn't have crossed your mind that anything like this would be happening. And so logically, the owner should pay nothing. But God fined them so that they would watch their oxen more carefully. In other words, So it's like the Gemara is admitting here that the two logical positions are either to say you pay full damages or to say you don't pay anything. And it's like the Torah, it's like God is intervening, according to the Gemara, to change the logical position from either full payment or no payment to half payment. I like this Gemara because the Gemara is kind of admitting openly that there is, it's not the most logical position to have of paying
half damages.
You know,
I guess none of us owns
an ox today, but if, you know, your dog, that you own goes and bites another dog and there's a vet bill, you know, that there are, I guess there are two logical positions to take on this subject. Either, well, dogs do that, and the owner of the dog that was injured should bear the cost, or that the aggressive dog, there's a certain responsibility for the action of the aggressive dog, and so then the burden of payment will fall on the owner of the aggressive dog. But kind of this decision of, well, let's split the difference and just, you know, you pay half and I pay half.
It's not intuitive.
It isn't intuitive law. And you see, this whole idea of looking to see whether the animal has been sufficiently guarded.
Now, Rashbam says the same thing about shomrim, about beilis, that when you give property to somebody, the idea is that, okay, so somebody gives something that they own to a shomer. Is the shomer responsible when the item is stolen? So Rashbam explains that the guarding of removables, chattels, that are commonly kept inside of one's house, you give me your book to guard for you. You appoint me your shomer on your book. So how do you guard a book? If somebody gives you a book, you put it inside of your house. So when you leave your house, you lock the door, you guard the other person's book the same way that you guard your own books. So the guarding of removables that are commonly kept inside of one's houses, and they were given to him so that he would guard them in the same way that he guards his own possessions. And that is why, if they were stolen from his house, the Beili isn't responsible for he guarded them, the Beili guarded them in the expected manner, as one guards one's own possessions. As long as I treated your book the same way that I treat my own books, if a thief comes into my house and steals my books and your book, then I'm not responsible because I did what's normally expected. And so that's why, you know, this dispute of Rav Papa and Rav Huna here is like, what is expected? You know, if you have an ox and it's in your barn or it's in your field or something like that, is it has cut shibur?
do we consider it to be sufficiently guarded, or do we consider it to be not sufficiently guarded?
Rav Shlomo explains further, but when a man gives to his neighbor an ass or an ox, since animals commonly graze outdoors, it is to be assumed that when he entrusted them to the Beili, he expected that the Beili would protect them from thieves, and accordingly, if they were stolen, the Beili is responsible. Because animals have will, and they walk around on their own, and they go to other places, that's why if I'm guarding somebody else's animal, and the animal wanders off and ends up getting stolen, then I have a responsibility. So it all comes down to the question of, is the item being protected, being guarded, to the extent that it is expected that an item will be guarded? So that's the essential question. But here we find, this is the case about which, in the 19th century, people started to notice that the laws of the Torah have something very clearly in common with other legal codes that existed centuries before the Torah. So from Assyria, from a document written in Akkadia that is, probably from the days of Abraham Avinu, a long time before the days of Moshe, the law code of Eshnuna, paragraph 53 reads, if an ox gores another ox and causes its death, both ox owners shall divide among themselves the price of the live ox and also the meat of the dead ox. And so, when the law code of Eshnuna was discovered, this was immediately people said, aha, the Torah is not a law code that is in a vacuum. It has legal traditions that were common traditions in the ancient world. And the language here looks so similar. You look on the right-hand side here of the slide of the English translation, when a man's ox injures his neighbor's ox and it dies, they shall sell the live ox and divide its price. They shall also divide the dead animal. It's the same it's the same law. The text goes on here to describe what happens if the owner has been warned. And Eshnuna doesn't go on to describe that. So it's not as if the Torah is like copying from Eshnuna and just saying, okay, whatever laws occur, there were. The Torah is clearly building on the legal traditions that existed in the ancient world and doing various things with those legal traditions that has existed in the ancient world. This is probably the clearest example of a real parallel between the law of the Torah and the ancient law codes of the ancient Near East. And why do I think that this is a significant similarity? Because as I just have been saying for the last few minutes, it's not an intuitive law. If you find two law codes that say, if you steal, you have to give it back. Or even if it says, if you steal, you have to pay double what you stole. It's not necessary to say that there is a dependence of the second law code on the first law code. People could intuitively come up with that kind of approach independently. It's hard to imagine that people intuitively came up with this kind of compromise. Okay, I'll pay half the amount and not the full amount. And the further problem with this is that the arithmetic is kind of strange, and this is what makes studying about comma a lot of fun. And some of you who went to schools in Toronto and are about my age may have enjoyed studying Baba Kama with Gemara teachers like Rabbi Shochet of blessed memory. We spent a long time talking about the arithmetic
The problem of the arithmetic, you know, it says here that that you split the live ox.
You sell the live ox and split the money, and
you also sell the carcass and you split that money. But as the Mishnah points out, that doesn't work very well. I translate here an uninvited ox. I didn't really don't know a good translation of a shore tom, a shore whose owner, an ox whose owner has not been warned.
An uninvited ox worth
100 dinars. The gored ox worth 200 dinars, and the carcass of the dead ox is not worth anything. Its owner takes the entire ox that gored it, since it is worth half the value of the damage. So in other words, you don't always split the Mishnah says, you know, it doesn't make sense to say, okay, sell the ox that gored and sell the carcass and split the proceeds. That only works if you assume that the two oxen are worth the same amount of money, but they aren't always worth the same amount of money. And there could be an ox that's only worth 100 dinars that kills an ox that was worth 200 dinars and the carcass is worthless, and then you would have to give up the entire the owner of the goring ox would have to give up the entire ox. And the Gemara also talks, it isn't just the Mishnah, but the Gemara talks about the case.
And what happens
if the goring ox is, let's say, worth 100 dinars, the opposite. What happens if the goring ox is worth 1,000 dinars, and the ox that was gored is only worth 200 dinars? And if you say, okay, let's split the value of the goring ox, then it ends up that the owner of the ox that's been gored now gets 500 dinars. He used to have an ox that was worth 200 dinars. It doesn't make sense to implement the law precisely as it is. And the Mishnah makes it very clear, we're not going to implement the law precisely as it is. It's almost as if the law code of Ishnuna is kind of assuming that all oxen have the same value as each other. And to based on that assumption, then we come to the Mishnah. The Mishnah realizes that couldn't be the case. So it says, well, if the damage is 200 and the ox that gored is worth 100, then you get the entire ox. You don't get half the ox. And then the Mishnah goes on, with regard to the uninvited ox worth 200 dinars, the gored another ox worth 200 dinars, and the carcass is worth nothing, Rabbi Meir said, it's about this type of case that it is stated, they shall sell the live ox and divide its monetary value. He said, here must be the case that the Torah is talking about when it says you split the value. It's only if the two oxen are worth the same amount. And then Rabbi Yehuda comes along and says, well, what you say is actually true. It's halakha, but that isn't what the verse is talking about. You have upheld the clause, they shall sell the live ox and divide its price, but you've not upheld the next clause of the verse, they shall also divide the dead animal. Wait a second, that's not what the verse is implying, that the dead animal, that the carcass also has some value. And so Rabbi Yehuda says, what case is the Torah talking about? It must be the case of Shor shave matayim shenagach shor shave matayim b'hanavela yachach hamishim zuz. The case is of an ox worth 200 dinars, the gored another ox worth 200 dinars, and the carcass is worth 50 dinars. In this case, each party takes half of the value of the living ox and half of the value of the dead ox. So the Mishnah struggles, and that's what makes studying Baba Kama so much fun, of trying to figure out how we are going to apply this principle here, sell the goring ox, sell the gored ox, and split the money. And as the Mishnah, the first paragraph of the Mishnah clearly pointed out, sometimes you're not going to do that. If you're trying to pay half the damages, you're not going to do this. So we have an unusual kind of way of formulating a law here, a way that the Mishnah is struggling with. And we have to note that the Torah is using language that existed well before the Torah to describe what is to go on. Okay, so that's the first case. Now we go to the second case, the case of an ox boring a human being. Actually, in the Torah, this is mentioned first, but I just decided that it would be better to present the material in this way today. So what happens when an ox bores a human being?
Well, the laws of Hammurabi, another
quote from the ancient Near East that's funny, a shnuna has, and Hammurabi, both have laws about boring oxen. A shnuna only has a law about an ox boring an ox, and Hammurabi only has a law about an ox boring a human being. I think that they were both kind of, to the best of my understanding, they're both kind of fragmentary law codes, both a shnuna and Hammurabi, and there must have been, in the societies that they came from, in Assyria, there must have been further laws that didn't survive in these codes. So what does it say in Hammurabi? If a bull, when passing through the street, the assumption is that a bull or an ox, whatever you want, however you want to translate, the translation that I used here says bull, but as Gary Ransberg pointed out, quoted in the beginning of this session, it's the same word in Akkadian and Hebrew, both for a bull and an ox. If a bull, when passing through the street, gores a man and brings about his death, the case has no penalty. It happens, you know. Bulls walk through the street. That's the assumption in the ancient society. Oxen walk through the street. And if they're walking through the street and they gore a human being and they cause the death of the human being, there is no penalty. However, if a man's bull was wont to gore, and they made known to him his habit of goring, and he did not protect his horns or have him tied up,
and that bull gores
the son of a man and brings about his death,
he shall pay one half mana of silver.
And if it be the slave of a man that he kills, he shall pay one third of a mana of silver. Again, we're obviously dealing here with a fragmentary law code here, because it doesn't say what happens if the
ox or bull here
gores an adult. All we have is the death of a
child or the death of a slave, and there is a
monetary penalty in the laws of Hammurabi for this. And if the in the first clause we have it goring a man and bringing about his death, the case has no penalty, but it doesn't say what would be the law if it gores a man after the owner had been warned that his ox was a dangerous ox. When we look now at the laws in the Torah, we see that there are various similarities to the laws of Hammurabi here, but here also we see some significant differences between the way the Torah presents this law and the way Hammurabi presents this law. So here we have in the Torah, when an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox is not to be punished. Remember what Hammurabi said. The case has no penalty. The Torah has legislated here that an animal that causes the death of a human being is put to death. And
my understanding is
that this legal principle, it has been accepted, at least in most Western law systems, that if there is an animal that causes the death of a human being, the animal is put to death, but the owner is not punished if it is a shore tom, if it is an ox whose owners have not been warned about the dangerous behavior of the ox. If, however, that ox has been in the habit of goring, so again, we have this distinction that we saw in Hammurabi. If, however, that ox has been in the habit of goring and its owner, though warned, has failed to guard it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner too shall be put to death. That it's an act of negligence here. You had an animal, you were warned that your animal was dangerous, and if you did nothing to protect other human beings for your animal, the owner also shall be put to death. And the Torah immediately qualifies it, though. If ransom is laid upon him, he must pay whatever is laid upon him to redeem his life. Halakha says, kofar has to be placed upon him.
That actually, when it says
here, the owner too shall be put to death, it's like a rhetorical statement that he deserves to die, but he is not put to death. The language is very strong here, that there is this responsibility of the owner because of his negligence. However, although kofar, it's made clear in the Torah, a murderer is not allowed to pay a kofar, to pay a ransom. If a human being commits murder, the human being cannot buy out of responsibility by paying a ransom. But if your animal has committed a murder, then there can be a ransom. And then the Torah, in a really unusual verse here, so too, if it gores a minor, so male or female, the owner shall be dealt with according to the same rule. Oven yigach obat yigach kamishpat hazeh yeyasa lo. Why do they have to say that it doesn't matter whether it's an adult or a child? Presumably, because in Hammurabi, they're making a distinction between an adult and a child. So here it really seems pretty clear to me that the Torah here is aware of and is arguing against the traditions of the ancient Near East that made this distinction. And then when we get to if the ox gores a slave, a male or female, he shall pay 30 shekels of silver to the master, and the ox shall be stoned. Again, in each of the situations, the ox is stoned, which is not a concept that shows up in Hammurabi. And there is a distinction between the killing of a free person and the killing of a slave, both in Hammurabi and in Exodus. But it seems like in Hammurabi, there's also a distinction between the killing of an adult and the killing of a child. And in Exodus, there isn't such a distinction. So here you can just see these the two laws beside each other. Hammurabi, bull passing through the street, of course, a man brings about his death as no penalty. And then the Torah on the right-hand side of the slide, the owner of this ox is not to be punished, but the animal is stoned. And then we have the distinction about killing a man or a woman, and we have a minor. And we have the slave. I don't think I have to belabor it and read through it again. I don't know. This is a different attitude to slaves. This is inflation from the days of Eshnuna. The days of Hammurabi to the days of the Torah. In Hammurabi, the penalty is 20 shekels. One third of a mana of silver is 20 shekels, and in the Torah, the penalty is 30 shekels. So it could be the Torah saying that a slave is worth more than they say. Now, why does, I said already that the idea that an animal that causes the death of a human being is put to death became a legal principle in Western law codes and perhaps beyond this, the Torah's idea here. But what is behind the idea? There are a number of Talmudic texts that talk about this issue and a number of places where Jewish thinkers talk about this issue. The example that I have here from the Mishnah Sanhedrin is not talking specifically about our case here of a goring ox. It is actually talking about the unpleasant case of bestiality, of a human being having sexual relations with an animal. The Torah says that the penalty is the death penalty, both for the human being and for the animal. To which, when the Mishnah discusses this, it says, "Im adam chata behema ma chata." You know, okay, so the human being sinned, but did the animal sin? What does it mean to say that the animal should be put to death? And the answer is, "Lefisha ba'al adam takala al yada lefichah abarakatu tisakel." Since the calamity came upon a person because of the animal, it should be stoned. Another explanation, the Mishnah says, if you don't like that explanation, here's another one. So the people that seeing the animal passing through the marketplace not say, "Ah, they're both the animal that led to the death of so-and-so." It's like a disgrace to a human being that if a human life is lost and the animal goes on living. I think that's this psychological reason why Western law codes have followed this procedure and said that an animal that is responsible for the death of a human being should not continue to live. Of course, there's the further idea that the animal is a dangerous animal. If we know that it has killed a human being, then it might do it again. And so the best way to deal with it would seem to be to kill the animal. Shadal, Samuel David Luzzatto, writing in the 19th century, says, "The killing of the ox isn't a punishment for the ox, but rather for the owner so that he will properly guard his animals." That's it. Why is the animal put to death? As a punishment for the owner of the animal. It would have been possible for the ox to be taken from him without being stoned. But the stoning was for the purpose of making an impression on the entire people so that they should see, hear, and be afraid. So, Laman Yiru, Vishnu, Vira'u. So, Shadal is making two points here. First of all, it's a penalty to the owner. And second of all, so if it's just a penalty to the owner, they're taking this ox away from him and giving it to somebody else. But the Torah wants to emphasize, according to the Shadal, the value of a human life. And if a human life has been taken, then we have to do something dramatic. So that people see that we care about the value of a human life. Furthermore, Shadal goes on, "In this way, an abhorrence of homicide would be reinforced in people's hearts, for it would be impressed upon them that he who sheds a man's blood, whoever or whatever the shedder may be, will have his blood shed by a man." So this is a way of increasing respect for the value of human life, the same that when human life is taken, there has to be a serious penalty. And so that for the educational value for the community, the animal has to die. As it says, "From every animal, I demand an account of it," in other words, of your blood. "And for man, his brother, will I demand an account of the life of man." So that verse there in Parshat Noach in Genesis chapter 9 really makes it, I think, very clear that God expects there to be an accounting for the taking of any human life, even if the human life is being taken by an animal.
The text there, with apologies to the
vegetarians in the group, the text there in Genesis chapter 9 makes it kind of clear that human beings are allowed to kill animals in order to eat them. And animals are not allowed to kill human beings. And that's the order of the world that God wants in the world, that animals will not kill human beings. And when they do, they might be... But if that happens, then the order of the world has been shattered. Shadal goes on, "And the meat of it will not be eaten." You know, there's a halachic problem in understanding this verse. The verse says, you stone the, you put the animal to death. Just think about it. They, you know, they put the animal to death, not by normal ways of putting an animal to death, but in a form of punishment that the Torah considers to be a punishment that's used for human beings. The Gemara talks at length about the fact that the same way that owners would be put to death if they committed homicide, the same civil procedures take place in the trial of the animal before the animal is put to death. So if you're stoning the ox, then is it necessary to say the lo ye'achel et besaro? Of course, we don't eat animals unless they were shechted properly, unless there was ritual slaughter of the animals. So Shabbat says, well, the prohibition of eating a nevelah, an animal that died by means other than shechita, had not yet been given. So that's why the Torah has to say, you stone it and you can't eat it, because only later on the Torah would teach us the rules that you have to slaughter through proper shechita before you eat meat. He says, and if you don't like that explanation, Rashbam has another explanation. It is to be further understood, as per Rashbam, that the meat may not be given to a non-Israelite or to a dog. That is, it was forbidden to derive benefit from it. There are other passages in the Torah that say, once the Torah does talk about shechita, it says, so what do you do with meat that was not shechted properly? And it says you can give it to an animal. They said, like, you have a dog at home, you're allowed to feed it to the dog, or you can sell it to a non-Jew. And so, and now the Torah is saying, so Rashbam says that when the Torah says here, sakol yistakel hashor, you stone the animal, below ye'achel et besaro, it means the passive here, ye'achel, teaches us that nobody's going to be eating this flesh.
An animal's not going to be eating it.
A non-Jew is not going to be eating it. That's what we do with this animal.
And then Shadal tells you what the Talmud does with the
phrase. The rabbi said that even if the ox was slaughtered by means of shechita before the stoning, after the sentence of stoning was pronounced, in other words, the court announced this ox is going to be stoned, and then the owner goes and slaughters it right away before it could be stoned. So the rabbi said that when it says here, lo ye'achel et besaro, it means that if the owner tried this fast one of doing shechita before the stoning could be done, it doesn't work. By means of shechita before the stoning, after the sentence of stoning, it was prohibited to derive benefit from it. This certainly is the law, says Shadal, even though it does not reflect the plain meaning of the verse. So that's not what the verse is saying, but of course that is the law, that is halacha, is what Shadal said. So everybody's trying to understand here this innovation of the Torah of saying that there is some responsibility upon this animal, and the animal is put to death. Rabbi Cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, died in 1935. In his letters, writes here, the idea of saying that animals have no free will at all is baseless. Of course, their free will is more limited than that of humans, but every creature has a share of free will appropriate to its abilities. To say that this ox has no free will, the book says, no, I don't accept this idea of saying that the ox has no free will.
And
citing scientific studies from the early 20th century, I don't know what studies he's referring to, but recent studies about animals show clearly that this truth, that the Torah already taught. So Rav Kook says that, you know, verses like this that say that we treat this animal that has committed the homicide, the killing of a human being, we treat it as if it has committed a crime. He sees that as part of the message here of the Torah, and he thinks that 20th century science has confirmed this idea that that animals have a certain amount of responsibility. But just for you to see, as I mentioned, it says there that if it's if the owner has been warned, it says the ox shall die and the owner shall be put to death. So Rashi says that Rashi is just reflecting the Gemara's position, the standard halachic position. Gambalav yulat bidei shamayim shall be put to death. It means that God will put him to death, but not that a human court would do something like this. Perhaps by a human court, yechol bidei adam. Scripture, however, states the one who smote is a murderer and should be put to death. In other words, there's another verse in the Torah that says that the only murderer who is put to death is the murderer who committed murder himself or herself. I.e., for a murder done by a person, the perpetrator is put to death, but not for a murder committed by the perpetrator's ox. We won't put somebody to death for this. And
I'm always, I think all of you know that I'm particularly interested in the Torah commentary of Rashi's grandson, Rashbam. Rashbam also looking here at this
verse says, Gam ba'alav yumat, he says, bidei shamayim, it has to be at the hand of God. Rashbam often is willing to explain the pshat in a way that does not conform to halacha. But here he says, no, the pshat is not that the human court will put this the owner of the ox to death. It is only God who will put the owner of the ox to death. Rabban writing about this, a rabbi is received by tradition that this death that's described here means by the hand of heaven. Similar cases are these verses. Any outsider who encroaches, you must, lest they incur guilt thereby and die for it. I have noticed, says Rabban, that where the Torah speaks of those liable to be put to death by a court, it does not mention just yumat, but it always says mot yumat. So Ramban is arguing that there is actually a linguistic difference between the kind of statement, this person here deserves to die, and the statement, this person here will be put to death by a Jewish court. And then, in the continuation of Ramban's comment there, he addresses exceptions to this linguistic rule that he has here. It works pretty well, but it does not quite work 100%. Anybody wants can look up the Ramban and see how he deals with the exceptions. And just a last kind of surprising text, Shadal often, Samuel David Luzzatto often surprises us in what he says. Also, its owner will be put to death. If I've been warned about my animal, that it's a goring animal, and I don't guard it sufficiently, and it goes and it kills another human being, then when it says here, Gam ba'alav yumat, the plain meaning is that the court puts him to death. That is the pshat, says Luzzatto. But the Torah permitted the taking of a ransom for his life, since he did not kill the victim with his own hands.
And then Shadal goes on, the Torah left it up to the judges to judge according to the nature of the person and the incident,
whether he was worthy of death or worthy of being saved by a ransom, and what the amount of the ransom should be. So Shadal says, looking at this verse, he says, I think that this means that the pshat means that the court will decide the level of negligence involved. You know, there are all sorts of acts of negligence, and there's a legal concept of gross negligence, And I assume that there aren't just three possibilities: no negligence, negligence, and gross negligence. It's a continuum. And so Chazal said that what the Torah is really suggesting is that the court will decide what the level of negligence is of the owner of this animal, who has been warned that he is the owner of a dangerous animal, and whether the ultimate penalty should be given to this owner for what he did, or would it be appropriate to have him pay a fine? However, the rabbi said that he was, that when it says that he was to be put to death, it means by the hand of God and not by the hand of a human court. So we see the rabbi struggling with these verses to try to understand them. And we see what I really wanted you to see today was A, that there are some strong similarities between the laws here in Parshat Mishpatim and the laws in ancient Near Eastern law codes that preceded Parshat Mishpatim, and B, that there are some significant differences too, and that there are other values and that the Torah does seem to be much more concerned about human life than those other ancient law codes. And in the classes that begin next week on strangers, widows, and orphans, we will continue to discuss the similarities and differences between what the Torah teaches about strangers, widows, and orphans, and what we find in the ancient Near East on this subject. But before next week, let's take a look at what we have here in the chat. Susanna says, I found it interesting the bull that got loose in an Israeli bank this week was referred to as a shor muad. I missed that in the newspaper. I got to go back and read the newspapers. A bull actually got loose in an Israeli bank this week? Who knew? Steve writes, is Rensburg's comment about Hebrew ambiguity regarding bull and ox correct? Do we not know when the sacrifice is a bull or an ox? I think
that he is
right. Marty says, isn't a bull a par? That Marty Crissell is suggesting that shor means ox and that par means bull. I don't know. You might be right, Marty. I'll take a look. Could be right. Might the machloket of Chaim Malk is writing here. Might machloket of Rav Papa and Rav Huna depend on whether we are discussing a bull or an ox? It certainly could, as Rensburg pointed out. There is a big difference between a bull and an ox, and so that could be behind it. I'd like to think that they're both talking about the same case, but they just have different understandings of the legal principle. Susanna writes, maybe we haven't found all the Eshnun and Hammurabi sources yet. 100%, Susanna. Why is the bull ox still alive if it gored in the past? The question, so the understanding is that it did not gore a human being in the past, it gored other animals. And then I should have been, I as the owner of the bull ox, should have been protecting everybody, other animals and human beings, from my dangerous ox. And so that's why it's still alive, and that's why
I have added responsibility, because
I've been warned about goring that it did. And now, even though in the past it just gored animals, now it moved on and gored human beings. Sam asks, how do we rationalize stoning
blocks around a cruel
death with the concept of tsar
bal chayim? I'm with you, Sam. It does seem very
very cruel, just as it is cruel to stone a human being. If it makes you feel any better, Sam, if you look at the Talmudic passages on the subject, they make it very difficult to actually put this into effect, just like they make it difficult to put capital punishment for a human being into effect. They also make it pretty difficult to kill the ox. Let me just keep going here for a second. I would think that killing the ox is done to prevent future tragedies. Yes, I agree. Are there laws about fencing in animals before the fact, as Bina? You know, there are discussions in the Talmud, like, what does it mean, velo yishmeranu? It says that if you've been warned, velo yishmeranu, and you didn't guard it, then this is what happens. So what constitutes shemirah? And there's one line in the Talmud, in the discussion in the Talmud about what constitutes good shmirah, there is one opinion that says ein shmirah l'shor ela l'sakin, that the only way of actually being certain that your ox isn't going to go off and cause further damage is by shechting it. And you're right, Rachel writes, take a look at our Elul series. And somebody wrote to me in a direct message, can we now say we are full of bull, or is it ox? I hope that we had no ox today in this session. And as I said, next week we will go on to what I think people consider to be more interesting subjects, although I do like boring oxen and the principles here. Yes. Go ahead, Susan.
Before you go, it says warning. Now, I know you need two witnesses for everything else, sometimes a one witness, but nobody's explained what warning is. And I'm curious as to what is a legal warning in the Torah.
So there is detailed discussion about this in the Gemara, about what constitutes he'adah, what constitutes warning. And I, to the best of my recollection, you don't need to have two witnesses for this to take place, but when it is known that the responsibility of the authorities to warn the animal owner, because he might not know, because animals did wander around in the ancient world, and the owner might very well not know that his animal has caused damage, and so the authorities come and they present the information.
So there's no specific rule what warning means, because so many things have rules.
Yes, so many things have rules. Okay, I actually have to get going here, and I look forward to seeing those of you who can join us in Elul, and it was very nice being with you for this whole summer series, and enjoy the last days of summer. We opened a watermelon today, and it wasn't as good as it was before.
That's a bad sign.
It's a sign that summer is coming to an end.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lakshin. Wonderful job. Your new microphone is wonderful. It was terrific today.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Really great. So thank you so much, and thank you everybody for joining us. We look forward to learning together in Elul.
And you'll be sending us a new link?
Yep. If you register for the Elul classes, it will be a new Zoom link. So please, everybody, thank you so much. That's a wonderful reminder. Everybody needs to sign up for the new Elul Zoom link. So take a look at the classes. The easiest thing is to sign up for the entire Elul series, and then you'll receive reminders for all of the classes and whether or not you can participate at the times of the classes. As I'm sure you're all aware, all of our classes are recorded, so you can learn with us on your time, on your schedule, even if you can't be at the live classes. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a wonderful week.